I promised you this morning that first of all, we have to concentrate on God and on Jesus Christ. If you don't have a clear vision of who God is and of who Christ is, never go on the mission field. Stay in America. The main thing, the most important thing of all, is to know the sovereignty of God, to understand the concept of the sovereignty of God. I don't know if you have ever got this explanation of the sovereignty of God, but let me tell it to you in my words. God is so sovereign, so much in command, that even his enemies always fulfill his plans. Even Satan always asks him permission to do certain things, believing that he with that will destroy God's work. And he always discovers at the end that somehow he just pushed God's purposes onward. That is God's sovereignty. Now you see, if you don't understand that, if you don't see that, you'll never have courage to go to the wolves. Now let me share with you one of the most beautiful moments of my life. 1974, I had 7 policemen at my door in 4th of October of that year. Oh, it's almost an anniversary these days. They confiscated all my library that day. And I won't go into that because it would sidetrack me. But they placed me under house arrest. And they called me to the police at the beginning of 6 months of interrogation. And that first day at the police, 6 senior officers in a solemn ceremony of charging me. When they told me what was my crime, it was propaganda that endangered the security of the state. Horrible words. And telling me that it's up to 15 years in prison for that. And going on and on to make it very, very serious and grave and disastrous for me. And when I had a chance to comment, imagine 6 senior officers and military prosecutor, it was going to be a court-martial according to their plan, and in front of them this poor man, defenseless. And I said to that man, I said, "Sir, what happens here is not between you and me. What happens here is between my God and myself. You see, sir, God has some dealings with me here. I don't know what. I believe that he wants to teach me a few lessons here. Anyhow, sir, you are going to do to me only what my God planned you to do. And you will not go 1 centimeter beyond what he planned you to go, because you are only his instruments." He didn't like that. But how I loved to see them, as ferocious as they wanted to seem, and see above them my beloved father pulling strings with his fingers to his puppets. That's how I saw them. Later on, all over Romania, I told that story. And I explained to my people how always, whatever the evil they want to do to us, eventually they just push us on and contribute to the glory of the gospel there. In one place, apparently they had an informer there. He taped the sermon, typed it then, sent it to the government, so that one man in the government one day said to me, "You know, I read your sermon on the sovereignty of God. You have quite an interesting view on us." God's puppets. Well, you see, you understand now the importance of the sovereignty of God. I love to see it in the Bible, in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 4. John and Peter were just threatened that if they don't shut up and continue to preach, they will get it. Now, Peter and John went to the church and told them, brothers, it's going to be trouble for us because we are not going to stop. And they told us they will do it big. Now, if we were there, we would have immediately started to pray, Lord, stop these evil people from doing this to Peter and to John. Lord, protect Peter and John. Lord, smash your enemies. Please go home and read the prayer of the church. Here is the prayer. Almighty God, you who created heaven on earth and earth, that's sovereignty of God immediately brought in the picture. Against your anointed Jesus, Pilate and Herod and the Gentiles and the Jews united only to do what you planned before them beforehand that they may do. They only did what you planned. Now these evil people started to work again. Now, the moment you already said that they do only what God planned to do, you cannot say, God, don't let them do it. You see, they already put themselves in a position where they cannot say, Lord, protect Peter and John and don't let the enemies do it to them. No, they cannot. The moment you said, you started with the sovereignty of God, they only say, give Peter and John boldness to preach and let their preaching be accompanied by miracles so that everybody sees your power at work. They don't pray for protection. That would mean don't let your enemies fulfill your plan for them. Now, I take that prayer from chapter 4 and I take it in chapter 12. You see, in chapter 12, James is, first in chapter 7, you know, Stephen was martyred. That led to the conversion of Paul. Then in chapter 12, James is beheaded. And then they pick up Peter. And everybody says that when the church prayed that night for Peter, they prayed for his release, but then when he was released, they couldn't believe it. And I smile and I say, that's not true. The church didn't pray for his release. Look in chapter 4. When you start with the sovereignty of God, and when you acknowledge that when they killed James, they just fulfilled what God planned for James, as they fulfilled what God planned for Jesus. Now, if Peter is martyred, didn't Jesus tell Peter that he was going to glorify God with the death of a martyr? These are the words at the end of John's Gospel. Jesus told him with what kind of death he was going to glorify God. And they just pray that God's purposes may be fulfilled in Peter too. Their shock at his release was because they didn't expect that. They didn't pray for that. Go back to chapter 4 and see it. You see, these people believed in the sovereignty of God. Always the enemies do only what he plan. Now, that means, brothers and sisters, that wherever I go in the world, they cannot touch me as long as I am down here and have a plan from God. I told those officers there, sir, When you kill me, if the Lord allows you, you only send me to glory. I am untouchable as long as I have a work to be done here. But then when the Lord wants to invite me to glory, He will use either a cancer or a car accident or a secret police boot or bullet. Doesn't matter which method. He invites me to go to glory. That is God's sovereignty. With that, I move among my enemies, and I know they are plotting even here to assassinate me. I was told by American authorities that, and I know that when I go to Europe, they might do it there to me. And people ask me, how do you move like that and you couldn't care less? Of course I cannot care less. As long as I have a job here, I am untouchable. I believe in the sovereignty of God. So, that is the first thing, to understand that your Father is in command and that He manipulates even your enemies for your ultimate good. There are no enemies for you in the world, as that's what I proclaimed in Romania. Only my Father has instruments for my good. With that kind of God, with that kind of understanding of the sovereignty of God, all this world is mine. That is beautiful. From here, let's go to the next step, to understand clearly who Jesus is. Forgive me for a moment, I am critical of some of the things that I see in America. Right from the beginning of my stay in America 8 years ago, I was rather shocked by some of the evangelism that I heard here. Come to Jesus and Jesus will give you that and that and that. He will give you great feelings. He will give you self-esteem. He will give you success. He will give you, if you have a Cadillac, He will give you two. He will give you prosperity and your bank account will swell. Come to Jesus and everything in this world will be yours, plus the next one. And I looked into my Bible and I said, what Bible do they use? This is not in my Bible. For one thing, I couldn't preach that in Romania because it wouldn't fit there. And I tell you something, if your gospel fits only in America, it's not the true gospel. You got that? You have to preach a gospel that fits everywhere in this world. And most of the gospel I hear in America fits only in America. So I asked this question, I said, well, wait a minute, what sort of Jesus do they have? Oh, I know what. He is a Santa Claus that distributes goodies. He is there just to pamper your feelings and satisfy your needs and desires. You go with your shopping list every day and say, here is the new shopping list. And don't you dare not fulfill my desires. I turn my back to you because you didn't protect me or didn't fulfill that or that promise. Now, the radical difference is that the Jesus of the New Testament is the King of Kings. You see, in Matthew 28, when Jesus, just before leaving for heaven, announces His disciples, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. If you understand language correctly, that means I've been just appointed the ruler of the universe. I've been just made the boss of the cosmos. I mean, all the cosmos is at my disposal, and including that principalities and powers and evil spirits, beings in heaven, on earth and under, everywhere, all the universe, all the cosmos is in my hands. I am the King of Kings and the ruler of the galaxies. I decide the destinies of nations and of individuals. And with that announcement and with that understanding, you know that at Pentecost, Peter has only one message. First of all, he explains to the Jews that the Jesus they crucified was raised up by God. But then he really shocks them with this announcement. You should know that that man who walked among you is now the Lord. In their language, Adonai, which in their language stands actually for God. He is made the ruler, the King of Kings, the boss of the cosmos and of the universe. And that announcement so shocked them that that moment they all came and said, "Brother, if that is true, we are finished. What shall we do? Repent. Submit. Come under his authority. Recognize his majesty the king. That's all you should do." Who is Jesus Christ? See, if you have a Santa Claus, you go to him with your agenda. You have a plan for your life, you map it nicely, and you go to him and say, "Will you, Jesus, bless it and fulfill it?" If he is the king of the universe, I go as a slave before him, and I say, "Your Majesty, I am here to take orders. What's your agenda for my life, Jesus? How do you plan to use my life? What's your place for me in this history? Your Majesty, you only have to say a word. I am there to do it." Now, the wonder of wonders. I'll come back to my attitude to him, but just to make the contrast between that fact that he is the King of Kings and the other next great truth that wonders my life every day. That King of the universe united himself to me so that we are one like a branch and the vine. And he lives in me. Oh yes, he lives in me in such a way that right now he looks to you through my eyes. And every day he thinks through my mind how to conquer the communist world with the gospel. Strategizing how to train preachers for the communist world. And he is speaking through my mouth, and he is touching people through my hands. And when I get tired, he suffers in me, and when I was beaten, he was beaten. You see, I only share in his sufferings. He only let me be partner with him in that suffering, of which I am going to tell you more, Lord willing, tomorrow. The greatest miracle of all is that the King of the universe is united with me in that organic way. And when in my devotions I come to that reality, I just bathe myself in that, and I just exult in that, and everything becomes adoration and beauty. What a joy to be united that way with the King of Kings. And it's more than that. His ultimate goal is to imprint his image in me. As I bathe in seeing his glory and goodness and servanthood and humility and obedience to the Father, more and more I say, "I like that. And I want to be like that. Jesus, make me like that. Imprint that image in me Let me be more and more submitted to the Father like that. Humble like that, meek like that, servant like that. My Jesus. There's nothing more beautiful in the universe than to be like you. Make me that. That's Jesus. Now, I'm a foreigner here, so bear with me because my English is poor sometimes. So I struggled with a word that I just couldn't figure out what it meant. That word is the word commitment. I just heard that fashionable word here everywhere, commitment and commitment and commitment. I was in a conference somewhere where somebody explained the word commitment and he brought a list of 24 meanings to it. And when a word has 24 meanings, it's meaningless. Now, you see, I started in life with the study of languages. I have a degree in linguistics. And I know that when a word becomes a fashion, that word says very much about the thinking of that nation. And I also know as a linguist that usually a fashion word replaces another word. There was a word in use before commitment. Somehow people didn't like that word and replaced it with this word, and now they use this one instead of the other one. So one day I said, well, what is the word that commitment replaced? And it dawned on me. I know. It's the word surrender. Now, why didn't they like the word surrender? Why did they replace it with commitment? Oh, I see. Well, look at these Americans. Hear clearly what they say. What is the essence of Americanness? Independence. Nobody should be my master. I want to be free and to be my master, my boss. Nobody should command me. The most cherished word in America is the word independence. Now, 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, you should know that whenever they preached about fullness of life with Jesus or the fullness of the Holy Spirit or life of victory with Jesus, true life or life abundant with Jesus, all the preachers would say, the key to that is full surrender. And they would explain to you how you search every area of your life and bring full surrender there. How you search your mind, your patterns of thought, your thinking life. Is that fully surrendered to Jesus? And you would search your readings, the novels you read. And of course you would search your TV viewing. Is that fully surrendered to Jesus? And you will go on and search your relationship. Is your courtship fully surrendered to Jesus? Is the kind of dating you do is fully surrendered to Jesus? And they would search like that every area of your life. And they would say, now, if you want true life with Jesus, surrender every area of your life to Jesus. But you know what surrender is? Surrender means that you lift up your hands to the one in front of you and say, you take over. I drop my defenses, I drop my weapons, I drop everything, and they say, you take over. And you let the one in front of you master you. You sell yourself. And apparently the speakers in America felt that the independent Americans wouldn't take that. Forgive me if I tell you, but I spoke about self-denial to a group of pastors somewhere in the on the other side of the South of America, United States. And one pastor turned to his neighbor and he said, "I would never speak on self-denial to my people. My people wouldn't buy that." This man knew what his people buy. And he would sell them what they buy. You see what they like. Well, they don't like full surrender. Well, then let's change terms. Give them what they want. Make it acceptable to them. Now, isn't the idea nice that you make it acceptable to them? So they gave up on surrender and they said commitment. Now, if you really go to the real meaning of the word commitment, it means engagement. You engage yourself to do something for somebody, like in a contract. You contract yourself to do something for this man, either because you want some money or just out of your magnanimity. You want to do something for that person, but you know that person, you are yourself. You remain yourself. You commit yourself to do that, but you don't give yourself. In surrender, you surrender the self. And that's death. I mean, it's death. Who likes to die to self? But that's surrender. And you should know that I don't use the word commitment. I refuse that word and I consider it like a leprosy. I am a man of surrender. Now let me tell you the other word that troubled me. You know how they are in America. They want to present you in pompous ways and your achievements and your degrees and all that. And after a few times when my flesh found some pleasure in that, I was rebuked and I felt fed up with that. And I said, well, what is the biblical way of introduction? And I went and I saw in Paul, the slave of Jesus Christ. I went to Peter, the slave of God and of Jesus Christ. And then I went to Jude. Now, Jude was the brother of Jesus. Do you know that? What an introduction he could have had. Jude, the brother of Jesus Christ. Now, listen carefully. I was brother with Jesus. Jude says, Jude, the brother of Jude, the slave of Jesus Christ. And he still wanted people to know from which family he came. So he says, and the brother of James. Everybody knew that James from Jerusalem was the brother of Jesus. Jude, the slave of Jesus Christ, and the brother of James. So I told the pastor, who asked me how to introduce me, I said, why don't you introduce me in the biblical way? Just say, Joseph, the slave of Jesus Christ. He liked it. He said, great. And he went to the pulpit and he said, Joseph wants to be introduced as Joseph, the servant of Jesus Christ. I said, well, why did he change? I didn't say servant. I said slave. And a few Sundays after that, somebody else asked me, how do you want to introduce me? And he said, introduce me as Joseph, the slave of Jesus Christ. Great! And he again said, Joseph, the servant of Jesus Christ. So it happened a few times, about, I think it was, 2 years ago, I had to speak at Trinity Seminary in Deerfield near Chicago. And New Testament professor in the office said, how should I introduce you? Again, I said, please, just say Joseph, the slave of Jesus Christ. Oh, I love that. And he started to write. And I said, but please don't change servant in slave. Slave in servant. And he just did. He just said, sir, don't you understand the astronomic difference? A servant, out of his magnanimity or out of for the desire of money, serves somebody. A slave has no choice. He is bought. And the Bible says that I was bought with a price. I am not my own. Sir, I don't condescend to serve Christ. I slave to Christ. Because he bought me with his blood. Then that man gave me the proper introduction. And I spoke 3 days in that chapel. Even after the third day, students were coming to me to tell me, thank you for that difference between a slave and a servant. That's the most meaningful thing for me to understand. You see, even Jesus. Now, Jesus taught us to address God as our Father. But he immediately says, Holy Father. And he tells us that at the end of a day of service, we should say, we are unworthy slaves. And he compares us all in so many parables with the slaves who were entrusted with God's things to administer. And at the end, he will come back and he will say, now come, my slaves, let me see what you did with my belongings. And at the end, at the judgment seat of Christ, I will tremble because I want to hear that verdict. Well done, good slave. The way Jesus taught me to relate to God was as a slave to his master. A slave. And that is why Paul says a slave. That's why Peter says a slave. That's why Jude says a slave. Because Jesus taught us that. And even he, you read in Philippians 2, don't you, that you should have the mentality of Jesus Christ. What is that mentality? He left his glory divine and he took the position of a slave. And as long as he lived here, he said, I am here to do the will of the one who sent me. I don't say one word but what he gives me to say. I don't do anything but what he says I do. My food and my drink is to do his will. Total subordination. Total acceptance to do the will of God. Absolute obedience. Now, brothers and sisters, you understand, Jesus is not but my buddy. He is my King. God, my Father, is my Holy Father. And I say, hallowed be thy name. Thy will be done in me as it is done in heaven. Here is me. Now let me conclude tonight with one of the most special experiences of my life. I was preaching there in Romania to persecuted people. In a country where nobody smiles because of the oppression of communism. And I wanted to teach my people to be happy. I even said to them once, you know, people tell me who come from abroad that they never see people smiling but in our churches. The communists took the smile from our faces and Jesus put it back. And I did a lot of training in happiness for my people. And here is how I put it to them. What is happiness? Once I put it this way, happiness is not being in America and having so many cars and having all those luxuries. Now, forgive me for saying that, but that's how I told them. I said, happiness is something else. Happiness may be experienced in a labor camp or in a prison cell. If you really understand the true happiness, here is how I define happiness. Happiness is to know that my God is pleased with me. Whenever I lift my head to see Him approving, nodding and saying, well done, Joseph. And if somehow I land in a prison cell and in a dump, cold prison cell, I lift my head up and I see that smiling father and he will say, great, Joseph. That's great. I would be the happiest creature on this planet. Now, my favorite song at that time was a Romanian song, freshly made, saying that life is like a journey through a day. You start the day with Jesus and you travel with Jesus all the day. And the last stanza says, at the end of the day, you will kneel down and say, Father, are you pleased with me? He will say, son, you've got another victory. Now, when I was arrested, actually, I was placed under house arrest. And for 6 months, as I told you, I had to go almost every day for interrogation. In those interrogations, they wanted to break my spirit and maybe my mind. It was a grueling time. And I was going there every morning, not knowing if in the evening they would let me go back home. Many times in the day where they would play with that, play with my nerves and say, you know you may not go home tonight, do you? We do whatever we want with you. But late in the afternoon, they would release me to go home. And as I left that prison where the interrogation took place, as I was on the pavement with the huge dark building with bars and the windows at my back, I was looking at the sky. It didn't matter it was sunny or clouded with lead color clouds. I would look up and recite that stanza. At the end of the day, you will kneel down and say, Father, are you pleased with me? And I would hear his whisper, son, you've got another victory. And happiness would inundate my being. I knew that he was pleased with what I did that day. And I was happy. The happiest creature walking on this planet, because he was pleased with me. But that day at the judgment seat of Christ, you know what Paul says about that in 2 Corinthians 5, 9, 10 and 11. Why he preaches. He says, I preach because I know the fear of God, the terror of God, because I have to stand there at the judgment seat of Christ. And I will tremble there at the judgment seat of Christ like Paul, waiting for that blessed last verdict. Well done, good slave. You are faithful over little things. I prepared for you the kingdom from the beginning of creation. Come, my slave, inherit the kingdom. That is happiness. So from tonight, you go home, please, and think of God the sovereign who moves empires and even his enemies serve his purposes. You then look at Jesus Christ as the King of Kings and ask yourself, my King, am I your slave? Do I really belong to you, or you take it as you take maybe tonight very, very lightly? I see some of you who couldn't care less for this message. I see it on your faces, and there are a few who all the time had something to speak or to smile. Doesn't matter. I spoke to you about my beloved king and about the real beauty. It doesn't matter that you don't want that slavery. Go on, be independent. I cherish that slavery because I know that only when I am slave of God I am free. I know something. The greatest happiness is when I can say all my being belongs to you. Will you come tonight in silence where you are to make full surrender?